Well, let's open with a word of prayer tonight, please. Father, what a joy it is to gather and to be able to open your word and to receive from you. Give us ears to hear, Lord, what you have for us. And may you find our hearts willing to respond. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, continuing through the book of Genesis, and you know we're in the patriarchal section now, and we have been spending time, quite a bit of time, on Abraham, and then we spent some time on Isaac, and then on Jacob. And now we're into basically our second time on Joseph, but there's a little gap here of a chapter called chapter 38 that it's back home at the ranch. This is not in Egypt. This is back in Israel. And we're going to be talking about Judah, of course, one of the 12 sons of Jacob and through which the Messiah will come. And so we will see a messianic line connection in chapter 38. It's kind of a little strange chapter in a way, because it's an interesting picture of Judah, who got fed up with how they were treating Joseph, having sold him into slavery. And so he goes about 10 miles away from Hebron to Adullam. That's those of you who've been to Israel, I know you've probably gone to the caves of Adullam, so you probably know about where that is. And then we're going to see him do some things that aren't too appropriate, but we'll see God's working even through all situations. And so interesting to see the messianic line coming through chapter 38. So 38, Genesis chapter 38, verse 1, it came to pass. So some time has gone by, we don't know how much, but it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite, and again, think the caves of Adullam where that's located, whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a Canaanite woman whose name was Shua, and he married her and went into her. Now, this is a pagan Canaanite woman. Now, it's really hard for the sons of Jacob to find wives. They can't go back to Paddan Aram because of the problems there with Laban. And so there are really no family to marry into particularly. But Judah here takes a Canaanite woman whose name was Shua. He married her, he went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur, meaning watcher. Now notice he names the first son. So that's a good sign, because he's the one who is to have the responsibility for the spiritual leadership in the family. And he is the one who's called to be true to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he's marrying a gal who is not. Now notice, by the time the second son comes along, she does the naming. She conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Onan, meaning strong. So it didn't take very long, and she's already naming the second, and she'll name the third child. So she kind of is, she's not being very submissive and falling right into line with the following the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob God, but she is worshiping the Canaanitish practices, it would seem. Verse 5, and she conceived again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. He was at Chesed, that we don't know, it's a small town nearby Adullam, I think, when she bore him, but in that same area. Now some time goes on, because now the firstborn is already marrying age. Then Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now, Tamar will end up in the genealogy of the Messiah. So there's some kind of sordid stuff goes on here in this chapter, but God is faithful and he will work through that. Verse 7, but Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. So we're not told any more than that. We're not told how he was killed or why he was killed, other than he was wicked in the sight of the Lord. So I'm sure he was following Canaanitish practices, and what the wickedness of is just enough that the Lord took him, killed him. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her, that's the second son, go into the first son's wife, now that the first son is no longer, and marry her and raise up an heir as your brother. Now, this was common practice And it's specifically common practice. Later, in about several hundred years in Deuteronomy, it will be incorporated into the law as the Levirate marriage. Lever means in Latin, it means brother. And this is, God had didn't want the family name to die out. So the family name always went to the first brother, and not the first brother, well, really, first son. And where there's no son, then the name wouldn't pass on. And so there's no son here. And so that would be the practice, to have the brother go in and marry the wife of his deceased brother. And the first son born in that marriage would be the heir to the original first son. So Onan rebels here, and whether he's rebelling against his dad telling him this is what he got to do, what he has to do or not, I don't know. But it says he didn't want to go into her. He didn't want to marry her. And so we see now this practice is going to continue on. But it happened then that, we go on down the line there a little bit in my notes here. I'll just touch on that. We have these names of women in the Bible in the genealogy of Christ. And the first one in there is Rahab, and she was a harlot, and she was a pagan. And then now here we have Tamar, who we see now she is going to be impregnated by her father-in-law. And then that's kind of an interesting twist. And then we're going to have Boaz, who's going to get involved with a Moabite by the name of Ruth. And then finally, the fourth woman in the genealogy is Bathsheba, who was the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So you don't have any Jewish women in the line, but you have four non-Jewish women in the line. And all of them had a reason why God had them there out of his grace and mercy, but not because of their genealogy and because of their coming from a line of godly people. But getting away from the story here a little bit. But here Onan in verse 9 knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went in to his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. So he kind of goes through with this, but then at the last minute, when the seed would be implanted to perpetuate his brother's name, he didn't want to do it, so he went on the ground. And the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore the Lord killed him also. Now, some like to make a big deal out of this, that's the penalty for admitting on the ground. No, that I don't think that's the penalty. The penalty here is because he failed to fulfill the obligation of raising up an heir, which he should have done for his dead brother. And God didn't like his attitude here, apparently, and what he did, so he killed him. So now two sons out of three have been killed. And so now the next son is younger right now by the Shelah. We'll get this in verse 11. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house. So she's under his control now because of her being married to his sons. But he doesn't keep her there in his house. He has her go back to her father's house and says, go back there till my son Shelah is grown, and then you can marry him. And then I'll let you know when to marry him, basically. And he said, lest he die also like his brothers. So wait till he's grown. Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So kind of a strange situation there. Now, what's Tamar going to do? I think she has great insight. I think she knows that her role in this whole thing is to raise up a son through which the Messiah can come. But if she's going to do that, she has to have a husband that's alive. She's had two husbands so far, and both of them are dead. So now she goes back to her father's home, and the time began in verse 12. Time passes. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to the sheep shearers, his sheep shearers at Timnah. Timnah is another 8-10 miles away. He and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. Now, the sheep shearing was a noted place for partying and various partying activities. So he's been maybe kind of grieving. I don't know how much he was really had such a great relationship with that wife or not. But anyway, she died, and so now in his comfort, he and his friend go up to the sheep shearers. And it was told Tamar, saying in verse 13, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, party time. So she took off her widow's garment, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself and sat in an open place which is on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as wife. So this is a woman that takes action. She sees that she's not going to have a husband, because she should have been given to Shelah at this time because he's grown, but she hasn't been given to him. And she's still under kind of that order from her father-in-law here from Judah. So now she dresses like a temple prostitute. Now, in those days, in the custom with the Canaanites, all the women had to serve as temple prostitutes for a period because they made money that way and gave money to the temple with their prostitution. And so it was common for the prostitutes to veil themselves. And if you saw a woman that was veiled in public, that would mean there's a woman that may be open for business as a harlot. So she knows where he's going to go when he's going up to Timnah. So she goes, makes herself up, disguises herself as a harlot, and now sits alongside of the road, and knowing that he will see her basically as he comes by. And verse 15 says, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face, having the attire of a temple prostitute. Then he turned to her by the way and said, please let me come in to you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? And he said, I will send a young goat from the flock. So she said, will you give me a pledge till I send it? Good businesswoman, I write. Verse 18, then he said, what pledge shall I give you? So she said, your signet, that means your family crest, usually on either a ring or on a necklace kind of a thing, or could be even on a bracelet. Here it's with a cord, it sounds like. Your signet, your cord, and your staff. Now, your staff would have had the engravings somehow of your name on it, because that was a very important thing. Everybody had a staff, at least all the guys did, because they would use that as a walking stick and use that in with the sheep herding and those kinds of things. But you would have a staff. And so that was all of these things now have specific identification to it. It would be, in other words, like you would be leaving your passport and driver's license and maybe your birth certificate or something with somebody, or at least a little bit along those lines. Then he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. So here Tamar now is conceived by the implanting by her father-in-law, Jacob. So she arose and went away and lay aside her veil and put her widowhood garments back on. Now, we see in verse 20, Judah, when he got back, sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. And he looked around and he said to the men of that place, where is a harlot who was openly by the roadside? And they said, there's no harlot in this place. What are you talking about? So he returned to Judah and said, I can't find her. Also, the men of the place said there was no harlot in the place. So Judah said, well, let her take them for herself, lest we be ashamed, for I sent this young goat and you've not found her. Obviously, Judah doesn't want to make anybody aware of what he did with this prostitute. So he did. He just, let's leave the matter lie and not make stir it up anymore. I tried. I sent the goat there and she wasn't there. And it came to pass in verse 24, there's always consequences, Judah. It came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. Now, that was a capital offense in those days. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. So that's kind of the reaction, according to this later will become codified. It isn't in law at this point yet, but that was the practice being done there. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry. So he said, bring her out and let her be burned. Wow. Interesting that he had sent her to live back with her father because he still had control over her life. But now, when this comes to into life, he has the ability, legally, I guess, to have her put to death. So, talking about women's rights in those days, they just didn't have many. And in any country that's not Christian, even today, women don't have much rights. And we see through Christianity, for example, in Galatians 3:28, now there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ. So spiritually, there's no difference between male and female. And that is a wonderful thing that comes from Christ, from Christianity, since Christianity, and where Christianity is the predominancy in the culture, even today. We thank the Lord for that. But notice Judah's reaction. Bring her out and let her be burned. Now, this is an amazing thing I think we should take note of. And that is how terrible our sin, my sin, looks on other people. When I see others doing the sin I do, I really detest it. How could they do that? That is so bad. And then I find in many cases that's what I do. But my sin doesn't look nearly that bad to me as theirs looks when I see it in them. And here is like a Judah's reaction as well. Let her be burned. Now, he didn't know that she was going to be able to identify him as the father, but he'll soon find that out. But here is how he reacts. And so my question here is to me, and maybe you can ask it to yourself as well, how frequently do I overreact to others who have committed a similar sin to that which I do or have done? And then, do I ever hate my own sin as much as I hate the sin of others? And the answer is, I'm afraid to say, is no. I don't hate my sin enough. I seem to have the tendency to kind of dismiss it, or, it's not really that bad because of the circumstances or whatever, as I see it in somebody else, and how wrong that is. It may even be a lesser transgression than I've been doing, and yet I really make a big deal out of it in a way as far as detesting it. And if that has any application to you, then respond to that. Verse 25, when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law saying, ooh, here it comes, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet, the cord, and the staff. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I because I did not give her to Shelah, my son. So he immediately knows, he immediately understands now the whole picture here, why she did what she did, because she wanted to raise up an heir, which she should have been doing for the purposes of God. And he sees, he's identified as the father. He sees that he is in this predicament because he did not give her to Shelah as he should have. And consequently, there he responds by he never knew her again. But God is going to work through this union, through the child produced, through this union of Judah and Tamar, to which to bring the messianic line through. So even though it's a kind of a sordid thing and isn't the way it would be, and if you think the Bible is just a bunch of myths, you'd never have things like this in the Bible. You would have it covered over or whatever, but it just tells it as it is. Verse 26, so Judah acknowledged them and said, I mentioned that she is more righteous than I because I never gave her to Shelah, my son. Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth, and behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Now, in that culture, it was very important to identify the firstborn because the firstborn always had the double blessing as far as the birthright went. So you always needed to identify which one is born first. So here a hand comes out. So she puts the red string on it But then afterward, pulls a hand back again. Verse 30, afterward, his brother came out and had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Well, I missed the verse 29. Then it happened as he drew back to his hand that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? So that's the name given to him, meaning breakthrough is Perez. The breach, the Perez is either the breakthrough or the breach. This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez. So Perez is going to be the one through whom the Messiah is going to come through that line. The other twin is Zerah. Afterward, his brother came out who had his scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So I'd already mentioned now that we have coming through this, these women in the genealogy there in Matthew 1, with the first one being Rahab, then the second one Tamar, the third one Ruth, and the fourth one Bathsheba. And I mentioned it speaks of the grace of God because they're all outside the Jewish race. But rather than disqualify them, as later the law would say to do, God does not disqualify them. He would rather wash us, cleanse us, forgive us, and use us as trophies of his grace. Because look at you who are saved, and I believe all of us are saved, or pray we are. He has washed us, he has taken us, and he has made us trophies of his grace. Although we had sordid backgrounds and shouldn't be in the line at all in a way. So I say there in my notes there, how truly thankful am I that he didn't disqualify me, but instead he washed me, cleansed me, forgave me, then to use me of a trophy of his grace. And I can, as Jacob would say in chapter 33, I have everything or I have it all. That was Jacob. Now here we're with Joseph, but we go on down through and we're with Judah right now, actually the son of Jacob. Now, there's something very interesting here in this genealogy. And in the Hebrew language, encrypted in Genesis 28, is something interesting in that if you go through and count backward, every 49 letters in Hebrew in chronological order, you're going to have the names spelled out of five of the Messianic line in order here, Boaz, Ruth, Obed, Jesse, and David. Amazing that God would put that in Genesis, because Genesis is 800 to 1,000 years before these Jesse and David are born. It's not that far ahead of Boaz and Ruth, but it's way ahead of all of those five names, and yet here they are in Genesis. And what does that mean? It means it is a prophetic sovereignty given encrypted message to us to show God knows in advance what's going to happen, really. It's just a prophetic thing as I look at it. If you want to find out more by that, I've got Chuck Missler's website on it. He didn't come up with this. Other people did. There is one famous mathematician, and I think Ivan somebody, I can't remember his name, in Russia, who came up with a whole bunch of these things. You have to watch when you start looking at encrypted messages, because there's a whole following on that, that they try to use this to predict what is going to happen. But this is not the purpose here. The purpose here is to, as you look back, you know God knew in advance what's going to happen. It's not prophetically saying it. It's just confirming it. That's the way it's going to be, I think. But he goes into this in great detail. So there's that website on the notes if you want to. You just edit, paste that into your browser and click on it. And it should open up for you if you're more interested in looking at that. I do not believe it's coincidental. I think that is God's hand in the scripture. Now we go on to chapter 39. And as we leave chapter 38, just remember, it is through this interesting aspect of Judah going into this, thinking he's going into a harlot. It's his daughter-in-law. But through that will come the Messianic line. And so through all of these names come from, well, they will come out of the union here, come through that union, and it'll go on down the line. So now we get to Genesis 39. We're back to Egypt again, back with Joseph. And this is going to be a great chapter to give us insight into temptation and how not to yield to it. as we look at the example of Joseph, because he gives us a great example here. But meanwhile, back in Egypt, Joseph found favor in the sight of Pharaoh, who had bought him and served him. Then Pharaoh made him, Potiphar, I should say. Did I say Pharaoh? Potiphar bought him and he served him. Then Potiphar made him overseer of his house, and all that he had, he put under Joseph's authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Jacob's sake. Now, we notice this pattern here. Remember back to Joseph's grandfather, to his father, Jacob. When Jacob was with Laban, what happened? The Lord blessed Laban for Jacob's sake. And now here we have Jacob's son, Joseph. He's blessing Potiphar's house, who bought Joseph as a slave for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So now Potiphar just keeps giving Joseph more responsibility. Now remember, when Joseph came down as a slave, he's only 17 years old. We had last time already, he was being given by his father in the flocks there back in Israel. He was given a superintendent position even over his older brother. So he is a remarkable young man. And you're going to see him continuing through this preparation that God is going to put him through. God always prepares us for what's ahead, and for the higher the calling, the greater the preparation. We talked about this last time, I think, and we remembered how Daniel was going to be prepared for a period of time as he was taken into Israel there. And of course, we have here Joseph now. He came to Egypt as a slave at 17. He's probably been there a little bit of time now. He's probably a 20 or so thereabouts. So let's say he's 20. Now it's going to be a period of about 22 years from the time Joseph was sold into slavery until Jacob will finally come into the land after the famine, and then into the second year of the plenty of the dream that Pharaoh would have, that Joseph interpreted and then was elevated to the number two man in the world, or in Egypt. So we see here now that he is blessed. Potiphar is blessed. And even in this suffering, and you know, here, just think what Joseph has gone through. He's been sold into slavery at 17 years old. And he will never, as far as he knows, will never see his parents again. He will never be able to really worship his Lord again in the land of Egypt the way he could have back home. And now he has been given charge of Potiphar's house and his holdings and so forth. But he doesn't complain. We don't see him complaining. We don't see him opening his mouth, similar to the way Jesus Christ did not open his mouth either, did he? Now, maybe he realizes, and maybe he hasn't yet, that this awful deed his brothers had done was actually a part of the purpose and plan of God for the preservation of the family. God is going to use Joseph in a major way, and he is going to prepare him now that way. He's already put him into an administrative position here by giving all of the household under Joseph for that experience, and as a very young man, as a slave, to have the slave have position. Just think of the animosity there over the other workers and all who were Egyptians. And here this Hebrew young kid comes in and he gets all the honor. But God is working. God is working. Now, one of our problems as we get put through the pressure, as we get put through preparation, is, and it goes on and on, we get upset with it and we get impatient, because God has not given us the ability to see what's ahead. All we can do is look back and we can see what the present is, but we don't know what's ahead. And we say, Lord, what are you doing to me? And what we think is just really a terrible, terrible thing, we'll be able to look back and see that was all for our good. You know, we find in the book of James that for the reason to develop us, we Christ's likeness, he gives us trials and afflictions that we have to go through. And there'll be a day now when Joseph will be able to look back and say, wow, all the way God's hand was upon me. And guys, you selling me into slavery, you meant it for evil, but God intended it for good. God wanted to preserve the family, so he sent me ahead to prepare the place and all. So we see this preparation going on. Verse 6. Thus Potiphar left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, a very similar comment made about his mother Rachel. Also about the first king, Saul in the land was handsome in form and appearance. So here Joseph is this 20-year-old, good-looking, handsome fellow. Just think about that. Now I see just a lot of good-looking people in the Bible, particularly in the line here of the kings and so forth. David was good looking and Saul was good looking. But I love Apostle Paul because Apostle Paul apparently was ugly. And I can only say I'm glad that God is just using beautiful people, because he would use most of you, but he wouldn't use me and a lot of others who aren't so beautiful. But here he is using Joseph. Verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing or lustful eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Wow. Think of that temptation. You know, your sex drive peaks in the early 20s or thereabouts, and here is Joseph right at that point. He's in a land where nobody knows him. He doesn't even know the language very well yet, probably. He's probably still learning the language, and nobody's going to tell. He could do with whatever he wanted to here. And she is saying, lie with me. Come, go to bed with me. So what do you think he's going to do? Well, verse 39, verse 8 says, chapter 39, verse 8 says, but he refused. But he refused. But he refused. And said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. Wow. Now, let's just talk about temptation a little bit as we go through this. Right away, Joseph refuses. I don't believe this was the first time that he caught that temptation, but I believe that he had been tempted and he knows what the dangers are. And I think he has already realized how far-reaching committing such a sin would be. Consequences of this temptation. If he would commit this sin, they would be all over the place. They would destroy totally his relationship with Potiphar. They would hurt the marriage between Potiphar and his wife. And I think it's so important for us in resisting temptation to think it through. And especially I'm talking about whatever our most vulnerable sin relating to temptation is. And we all have them, I think. Maybe it's a different one now than you had earlier or whatever. Or maybe there's two or three things that you see recurring, that you find yourself doing more than once. We need to think ahead of what the consequences of committing that sin are, how far-reaching it will go out. How will it affect maybe my spouse, my whole family? How will it affect my witness, my reputation? We need to stop and think. And what a few minutes of carnal pleasure could cost us, it could change our whole life. So I think Joseph had already decided in advance of what he would do. It's a settled issue with him. When this temptation comes, and we see it now, she's going to tempt him day after day after day. Just think what that temptation is. It's a settled issue in his heart. He says, no. When that temptation comes, it's no. It's not, I'll think about it, or I'll decide when that happens, and then I'll decide what to do. If you don't say no in advance and have that commitment in advance, and you say, well, I'll make the decision when it happens, you're going to give into it and you'll go headlong into that sin. That's just the way we are. But he says no. Now, when we need to settle it ahead of time, whatever that dangerous temptation is in our lives, we can then come to the Lord and say, by your grace, help me to respond to this and help me to get that settled every single morning, praying that model prayer, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. So we need to pray. We need to pray that during the day as well. What's going to happen? What has to happen for sin to occur? You have to have a temptation, and then you have to have the opportunity for those two things to come together. When those two things come together, your lustful desire to do something, you're just waiting for an opportunity on one hand, what the body wants to do. And on the other hand, when that opportunity comes and those two intersect, then you're going to plunge headlong into that temptation, into that sin. But we need to say, Lord, help us to say no when that temptation comes. That we would not have a joining together of that temptation and the opportunity. A daily commitment, or really a many times a day commitment, really, to step back and look and assess what is really valuable in your life, and that is a relationship with the Lord, right? And sin always separates us from that relationship. Not to allow the devil to take away that from us. So my question here for myself, and for you maybe, how well am I handling temptations? Have I really decided in advance what I will do when being tempted? Am I really beginning every day by praying, Lord, don't allow me the opportunity to sin? How clear am I in stopping, looking, and assessing with the Lord what is really valuable and important to me that can be taken away by the devil in my yielding to temptation? I think this is a very serious thing. I think this is a great example here in chapter 39, one of the best in the Bible, of seeing. Just think what all that Joseph had been through. He has all kinds of excuses why he should sin if he wants, maybe giving up on God, you know, being sold as a slave, and now he's down there, and now he's being tempted by this. I'm sure she's a beautiful woman. You know, Potiphar is a powerful position, and powerful men, particularly in those situations, usually have beautiful women. And here's this beautiful woman who is making a move on this handsome, good-looking, young, strong 20-year-old. So now he goes on into these three things that we're going to take a look at in saying no. In verse 9, Joseph says, there's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he, Potiphar, kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So let's look at these three reasons that he gives here in saying no. First reason, he says, no, there's no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me. It would just be flat out wrong against Potiphar, who has put his entire trust in Joseph, having done this, to turn around and sin against his wife. Entirely the wrong thing to do, especially someone who's placed such trust in me, committing everything he had into my care with full confidence. So, the impact on others there, particularly the impact on, in this case, one who had done so much trusting of you. Second reason, how can I do this great wickedness? Now, great wickedness is an interesting term, because down through the ages, we know exactly what great wickedness is. But notice in our culture here today in the United States, I don't know what I've ever heard on a news report or read in a news article about it's a great wickedness. I don't think we use the term wickedness anymore. But Joseph uses it. He knows what it means. How can I do this great wickedness? And I just wanted to read off some statistics that I gathered from Joe Foch, who had it in one of his commentaries. This is not current. This is maybe 10 years old, 8 or 10 years old. But the statistics are not going to be better than this. They're going to be worse than this because we're moving even further away from the Lord. And I don't expect you to remember these or anything else, but you may remember the idea in some of these. This shows what great wickedness reflects itself in the culture and in the lives of a country of the United States right now. These are the statistics that wrote down. 30% of all who call themselves evangelicals divorce today, 30%. 50 to 60% in our culture across the board are divorcing from marriage. 43% of 18-year-olds that grew up in church today have had intercourse, 43% of 18-year-olds. 65% of kids in high school of age have had some sexual activity. 23% of 12 to 13-year-old kids think it's acceptable for unmarried people to be sexually active with each other. One marriage ends every 27 seconds in this country. Think of the feelings, the pain, the emotions, 120 per hour. In the next hour, 46 girls, think of this, 46 girls in the next hour under 19 will get an abortion. Wow. In the next hour, while we're doing this study, 600 children in America will be the victims of broken homes. Tonight, 40% of the children in the country, I think it's even higher than that now, will go to bed in a home where there is no father present. Every 24 hours, 1,400 babies will be born to teen mothers in this country. Every 24 hours, 3,400 born to unwed mothers. And every 24 hours, this is a shocker in a way, you know this, 3,700 abortions, one every 24 seconds, two a minute. That's the average number of abortions going on. So we have sinned. This is great wickedness. And so Joseph is saying here, first reason, I could not do that to someone who's put such trust in me. Second reason, this is a great wickedness of committing adultery. This is a great wickedness. I'm saying no to a great wickedness. And then the third, and really the most important reason, I cannot sin against God. When we sin, when we yield to temptation, we're actually sinning against whom? Against God. Who are we going to stand before Judgment Day, and who are we held accountable for when we are judged? It's by God. It's not by man. It's not by our friends. So our sinning is against God. That's why he hates it so much, because it separates us from him. And just think, he's always faithful in warning us ahead of time of when we consider to sin. He always warns us, don't do that. And we need to stop and think about how good he's been to me, how he just blesses me every day, giving me what I don't deserve. And as I look at the cross, is thinking what he has done, dying that I might live, paying the price of my sin and redeeming me, and then clothing me with his robes of righteousness, saving me, glorifying me eternally. And think I could throw that away by yielding to temptation? Well, Joseph didn't. He refused. So this is a great example for all of us. David would say in Psalm 51, after the Bathsheba sin, against you, God, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight. There's the same idea. David saying there, it's just against God compared to everybody else. It's you and you only I've sinned. And then just thinking the fact that I am something special, you as a child, God, are something special. And as his child, how can we sin and do this great wickedness against God by yielding to temptation? Now, she's able to say no to him day after day, but now she sets a trap for him. So finally, one day, she's going to pick this day. to have Joseph, when no other man's in the house, she's going to approach him. And so we're going to see that here as we go forward. In verse 10, so it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. You know, Paul tells us in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who would call on the Lord out of a pure heart. So he's saying, flee youthful lusts. When you get into a situation that you know you can't handle, run, get out of there. Don't stick around to find out, flee. And so this is what Joseph is doing here. Verse 12, as I read, he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Verse 13, and so it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called to the men of her house and cried out, saying, see, Potiphar has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when he heard it that I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. Well, you know, it's been said, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. So here she scorned, and so she's going to scream out these lies against him that he was trying to rape her, and it was only by her screaming that she was able to keep him from doing it, and he fled, and she had his garment. So verse 16, so she kept the garment with her until her master came home, until Potiphar came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, that Hebrew servant you brought to us came in to mock me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. Verse 19, so it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. Now I can imagine a whole lot of things would be going through Potiphar's mind at this point. It doesn't say he was angry at Joseph. He may have been. But I mean, here is the apple of his eye, so to speak, who has trusted everything to this guy, and he has blessed him. The Lord, he doesn't know it's the Lord, but he has been so blessed with Joseph. And now, with this accusation, he's got to do something, and it's going to end that relationship, or certainly change that relationship. So no wonder he's angry. So what's he going to do? Well, if he really believed his wife, with his position, he was the head of the executioners. That was his role in the government. He would have had Joseph put to death. I'm sure of that. But he doesn't do it. Verse 20, it says, then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison. Now, not just in any prison, into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. So it's thought that this is a higher, better prison. It's for the king's guys, not just for the common people, where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. So now the plot really gets even darker. Think of Joseph now. He's been through so much, sold into slavery, and now accused falsely, and now he's in prison. You think it could get any worse? Far from home, far from his family, far from alone, accused as a rapist, sitting in prison. But we don't see anything about Joseph speaking up for his own defense any more than we saw Christ speaking up for his own defense. He opened not his mouth. And the only thing that I can figure is that he is so totally committed to God realizing that he, as a child of God, he belongs to God, so committed to the fact that he was God's that he realized all things work together for good, even though it seems to be the most horrible thing that can happen to a young man in his 20s. It'd be like us going down to Mexico and getting thrown into jail and having no appeal, no friends, no support. But what does Joseph do? Well, he makes the best of it. So, question, do I fully realize and act out in my life that I'm really God's child? That I'm so special, being purchased, redeemed, and set apart by and for him? Does my life show that? Does your life show that? How special we are because of what he's done for us? Verse 21 says what? But the Lord was with Joseph. But the Lord was with Joseph. Let that sink in for a minute. Under this terrible condition. Now remember, God is preparing Joseph for what's ahead. He's not just doing this out of some, of course, when we say why God, we never know how God works. It's just always the best. But we see here this preparation that he's doing. God was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. So now the same thing happens again as happened with Potiphar in his house. It's happening with the keeper of the prison. And again, the Lord was with Joseph, a repeat there. And the Lord was with Joseph, even in prison. He showed him mercy. And what kind of mercy was that? Well, the Lord gave him favor in sight of the keeper of the prison. He was just an honest, diligent, good person that everywhere he went, people liked him. Just a likable fellow. Wow. And we read in verse 22, and the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, wherever they did there, it was his doing. So notice here how he's getting this administrative experience here. He's got control of the prison, and you got these prisoners. I mean, these are not easy guys to get along with or to control, right? But he's got them all under his command. He's being put as manager of the prison, begin to run the institution in charge of everything. What training it is for him. Notice verse 23, the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority. That's almost word for word what was going on under Potiphar. Such trust there. Just think of this. And here's a kid in his 20s. Amazing. Why? Because the Lord was with him. Here's his was with him, was with him, was with him. The Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. So it reminds us the Lord can be with us and is with us in whatever circumstances we're in, even the most adverse circumstances. I wonder how many times Joseph didn't bolt here. He didn't turn on his heels and run. You know, he could really, as be probably the trustee of the prison here, gotten out of prison if he'd really wanted to. I don't know for sure. But at any rate, I don't know that that could have happened. But anyway, he is just continued to be faithful, continue to be faithful. I wonder how many times we foul up God's plan by bailing out when the pressure's on. You know, it's like, well, I put up with this, Lord, for 2 weeks or maybe 2 months. But man, it's going on and on and on. I can't just spend my whole life waiting for you to do something, God. I'm getting fed up here, is what we might think. Now, we realize Joseph spent years in prison. Yes, God is working. Even in the experience, God's hand is on him. In the overall sense, he's working out a fantastic program that he's going to put Joseph in charge of into. So, question that I have here, does my life demonstrate perseverance in doing God's will in my life? Or do I bail out too soon? Do I ever thwart God's plan by quitting? Good question. Perseverance is so important, isn't it? Not that it looks like it's working out at all, it's getting worse. but I need to persevere in doing his will. Maybe you're going through some heavy, heavy things right now, and you just like to bail out. When can you get out of this outfit, so to speak? We got to be true to him, knowing that things do work together for good, and he loves us, and it's all being done by him in these kinds of things for our good, because he loves us so much. So this brings us to the end of chapter 39, and it's a great study. Spend a little time on it as it relates to your temptations and your yielding to them or not. And see what we can learn from this as we go forward. So remembering the Lord is with Joseph, the Lord is with you. He's with each of his children under all circumstances. Good health, bad health, prosperous times, times of want, times of freedom and liberty, and times of imprisonment and so forth. Whatever it is, he is with us. So I just want to close with this benediction song, really, and it closes, he is with you, he is with you, he is with you. And that's what we've been talking about here right now. So let's sing along with this, if we may. The Lord bless you and keep you.
The Lord bless you and keep you. Make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace.
Father, we thank you that you are with us, ever present with us. And Lord, I ask your blessings on each one for sure who's tuned in tonight to these two chapters, Lord, and help us to glean at what you have told us and taught us. Help us to look forward next week to dreams taking such an important part into the whole messianic line here as the dreams will come down of the famine and the 7 years of plenty and so forth in the land, and such great chapters there on dreams. And so help us to stay touched with what you have for us. May you find us bringing honor and glory to you, blessing to you with our lives, as we would be living our lives led by your Spirit and available for what you have for us. So help us, Lord, to reflect you to those around us, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.